All right, good morning, everyone. Welcome to Wonkland. Yeah, good. We're really delighted and delighted that to announce this will be a PowerPoint-free presentation. The applause waves in. So we're here to talk about the grid with three people who know quite a lot about it, and then there's me. So I've been here since Tuesday, and there's been a lot of discussion about oil and gas and all sorts of things like that. You know, basically we run on electricity, and it's the world's largest machine. And we probably are going to depress everyone by talking about the problems and the potential catastrophe are awaiting us with 70% of our electric infrastructure aging at a almost as fast as I am. The little research I've done, the outage minutes with the United States, they're going up in greater duration and frequency while the rest of the world goes down 6 hours a year in the United States, 11 minutes in Japan. The economic cost to us, the burden of renewables, we think that's all wonderful, but it's the generation gap, as some people like to talk about. How will we integrate that into our electric grid? What will the grid look like? Is it bulk generation, distributed generation, and storage? So we're very, very lucky that we have three people who gave up their Saturdays to spend time with us today. And I will start with Lorenzo Christoph, who is, believe it or not, an actual human who works at the California Independent System Operator. He's market and infrastructure policy. Okay. Heather Sanders, who works for my utility, which is Southern California Edison. She's going to give us that point of view. And John White, who's very familiar to a lot of people here, the Center for Energy Efficiency and Renewable Technologies, who will be kind of the man in the middle in a way. He's unaffiliated with all this. So I'll just start with the puffball general question, which is to our panelists. And excuse me, we really, really want a lot of questions because I'm a blowhard because I'm a reporter, but and these guys would be very happy to engage with any of your questions, and especially if you're writing stories. Oh, excuse me. I'm the least important person here. My name is Julie Card, and I work for Cal Matters, which I feel compelled to always say is a because I'm new to it. It is a nonprofit. It's the new model of journalism. I work at the LA Times, which is also a nonprofit.
In a different way.
In a different way. Yeah, inadvertently. It's what we're all going to end up doing. It's a small shop. We're funded by rich white people, and we write stories and give them to partners throughout the state and NPR. So the general question to you all, I know, I just can't be taken out. That's my problem. Lorenzo, without frightening everyone, what do you see as the challenges, the concerns that face us with the new energy future and the way the grid is structured and what needs to happen to make it work better?
Good morning. My name's Lorenzo Christoph. I work at the California ISO, where I've been for 17 years, actually, and I basically invent things that other people have to implement. I'm in the policy area. We come up with different changes to market designs and how they work. I'm afraid I might need to disappoint Julie a little bit by not being frightening or pessimistic enough. Frankly, I don't see the challenges as being inordinately technical. I see them mainly being cultural and institutional. That's where change has to happen. And some of what I want to do is kind of challenge what are very conventional ways of thinking. And to me, it all looks like a vast opportunity where we have a lot of work to do. I become very fond of a little poem by the 13th century Persian poet Rumi, who says, "Stop, be still, and listen, because you're drunk and we're at the edge of the roof." I take that as a timely warning because there is really a lot to do, and much of it involves changing the way we think about things, the way we think about energy, the way we think about institutions, the way we think about electricity and how we use it and what it's for. So what's happening with the arrival of renewables, triggered to a large degree by the renewable portfolio standard, but also the economics of declining prices of solar, is changing the grid from two dimensions, one of it being these central station plants with a lot of solar energy that are being built and changing over the fleet. But I think an equally important story is decentralization that's happening on the system, technology making it possible, customers choosing to do different things with how they use and obtain energy. And so we've got a system all the way from the regulatory agencies and the big companies and the policymakers and how it all works down to the end-use customer, which was designed around big central station power plants, a high-voltage grid, energy flows one way out the distribution system. There's the customer at the end flipping light switches or turning on whatever equipment they want. So that whole model is basically becoming obsolete, and what we need to do is create its replacement. And its replacement is going to be something like a whole lot of decentralized systems that are connected to a grid that still continues to exist. There's still value in the western region of getting wind-rich areas like Wyoming and having them generate a lot of energy that goes into the grid. But by and large, the total volume of energy that flows across the high-voltage grid needs to go down, because it will be replaced by local supply to meet local needs. A lot of the drivers of that, and here I want to attack another prevalent myth of how we think about policy and large systems, is that it's all about big institutions making policy decisions or business decisions, and then it's the individual end-use customer. And I encounter this throughout the industry, and I do a lot of speaking at conferences about power system change and so on. What's missing from that dialogue is that we're not all just individual consumers. We are communities. We're cities and counties. So in the last panel, I was listening to discussion about the convergence of water and electricity. But what's typically missing from the discussion is the fact that when we consider the possibilities of a more volatile future, particularly from the ecosystem damage we've inflicted and set in motion that is going to play out over decades, it's really a question of resilience. How do we create resilience so that we can sustain a reasonable quality of life in a more volatile future? And my proposition here is that resilience is a local capacity. So how do we start thinking beyond the big institutions and the individual customers and their decisions to acting as communities, seeing cities that have to provide municipal services being on the front line of the volatility? And it's not just ecosystem damage, but it's also economic volatility. How do they think about energy, local transportation, water supply, wastewater treatment, waste management, even food and local business and local economy as a whole system? So part of the recipe here is to move from compartmentalized thinking to whole system thinking. Think about resilient communities and resilient cities. For all of this, the electric grid is a central structure that enables this kind of whole system thinking to be able to develop. And so, to me, that's the opportunity and that's the work to be done. I don't see it as that terribly, let's say, overwhelming. It's really something that we are very capable of doing, but the change starts in how we think about the problems.
Good morning. I'm Heather Sanders, and I have been with Southern California Edison for 1 year. Prior to that, I worked with my friend Lorenzo here at the California ISO. I think this is an amazing time to be in the electricity industry. It's amazing. So we get to buy electric cars. I have two. We get to generate our own power. We get to have really fancy things in our houses. Like, I mess with my husband and change the thermostat when I'm not there just for fun. I can turn the lights out. I mean, I get to do all of these amazing things. And at the same time, when I look outside in LA, I'm like, my gosh, one day I'll be able to see those mountains every day. So we at Edison are taking this very seriously. We published a white paper last week, and we have some copies in the back, but talking about the role that distributed energy resources and our customers play in reducing greenhouse gases. And there is a lot to do to get there. And we definitely need to pay attention to the grid. We need to create this platform that enables all of these amazing choices that we have as customers to generate our own power and have our own choices. And so for us, the challenge is really about getting started now, understanding it's going to take time, and all working together to make it all work. We definitely need to modernize the grid. It wasn't built to do what we're asking it to do today. We need to make sure it's safe. So when I say it wasn't built to do what we're asking it to do today, Lorenzo hit this a little bit. Power comes from the central generators. It goes along the wires to homes and businesses. Along the way, we have devices there to make sure it stays safe. So I read the daily outage report because I'm a geek and I think it's fun. Balloons, Mylar balloons, squirrels, trees, cars, cause outages every day. Every day. Three balloons yesterday. I read it this morning before I came in. Three balloons. I'm like, what are we doing? We're so celebrating of balloons. But they cause outages. And when those outages happen, right now what we do is we switch the system so the power can flow around that and ensure customers get that. Now, when we have customers generating power, we're going to have more flexibility for that. Distribution system is very, very dynamic. We do 22,000 switching operations every year. So someone makes sure the power gets routed to our customers when those things happen. We need a more dynamic grid to be able to ensure that power flows. The other thing we need to think about is how do people pay for the grid that they use, and is it fair? One of the things we need to think about really seriously in our rate design is, you know, how are people using the grid and are they paying for that benefit of the grid? And so we'll need to work on that as well. So there's a lot of opportunity here, and we at Edison are really supporting, you know, this evolution. Again, we've laid out this in this high-level plan, and I can talk about a lot of details, but I think, you know, I'll just stop there for now and hear from John, and then we'll get your questions.
Thank you, Heather. I'm John White. I'm the director of the Center for Energy Efficiency and Renewable Technologies. We're based in Sacramento, but we operate throughout California. We're a small group of NGOs and renewable energy companies. We've been around for 25 years, and we've participated in the development of policy and regulatory strategies around the idea of reducing the environmental footprint from the electric grid, starting first with air pollution. We actually thought more about air pollution at the beginning in the early 90s, and then global warming, which I always think of as a subset of air pollution rather than something separate, became the focal point. I think Lorenzo made a very important point that the challenges we face to achieve a modern, economic, and reliable low-carbon grid are not primarily technical or economic. They are institutional. And I think a couple of thoughts on where we have a need to improve. And I am optimistic also, but I'm also worried that we have to adapt quickly at an institutional level to the success that we have achieved in the last particularly 10 years. California has demonstrated its the capability of large amounts of renewable development, winds and solar especially. Also, rooftop solar and distributed generation are further along than anywhere else in the United States. And we are now, along with Germany, becoming a proving ground or a test bed to take these ideas to the next level, where instead of having renewables be added onto the grid as like a green side salad on the greasy fossil fuel burger plate, you know, where we feel better about ourselves because we got some green on the system. We're now talking about running the system primarily on renewables and zero carbon resources. And one of the things Julie mentioned was the problem of integrating renewables. Well, the problem with integrating renewables, and people talk a lot about flexibility as the key thing that we're going to need to have on the system, because we have this phenomenon where as much as we love solar and as cheap as it is, it all comes at one time in the middle of the day. And it's seasonal as the arc of the sun, we know from Stonehenge, you know, changes over the course of the year. And we have a situation where in the spring and the fall, where you have a lot of sun still, but temperatures are lower. So in the spring, you got the windows are open and the breeze is blowing, nobody's turned the air conditioning on. Those light load conditions have to then be matched with abundant solar that may exceed the needs of the system. So one of the ideas that I think we have to start thinking about, and the way one of my colleagues, Jim Caldwell, said that the biggest need for flexibility, the place where we need flexibility is the 6 inches in between our head, okay? That we have to change how we think about electricity. And, for example, the model that Lorenzo talked about was we run the generation to match the load. Okay, so the idea of having a centralized grid that balances itself in real time to meet the whatever the demands of the load are, we need to change that paradigm to start thinking about bending the load curve towards where the abundant electricity is. So, for example, demand response becomes a very key strategy. Where we can charge electric vehicles at a time when we have abundant energy. We can preheat and pre-cool buildings at that same time. And then we have to find a way to reduce our consumption or supplement what generation we don't have when the sun goes down with stored energy, not just from batteries, which remain expensive, but from large-scale dams that we currently have and could build others in the form of pumped hydro, where we can have long-duration storage that can match the system. But what all this tells us is that the planning and infrastructure and procurement policies have to be, as Lorenzo said, more holistic. Right now we have a lot of categorical programs and a lot of mandates and a lot of specific things we're trying to get people to do, and the key for the future is to fit these things together and have it all work. I think the capability is there, but it would require new thinking and new ways of implementing our policies.
So, John, now I'm going to start calling renewables kale because that's kind of super groovy, so it's a salad type thing. Mm-hmm. So, Lorenzo, without getting too far into the world of electrical engineering, talk about renewables and how they're integrated. Utilities like command and control, because you're responding to things. Everything that we own is designed for the most part for continued and constant power. Renewables are intermittent, which is what we've been discussing.
Some
geothermal. There you go. How does it from for people like me, we're standing at a cocktail party and you're just going to give me how do you do that? How do you take something that's intermittent that you can't count on and you want to store it over here, and we'll have to talk about storage. How do you make that part of the electrical system?
So when we look at operating the grid, I mean, the point that John made is a very good one, that for the most part, traditionally, here's all this load out there. It's consumers doing things, whether they're businesses or residences, and we're trying to dispatch the generation, operate it with very short-term time signals to be able to, on a moment-to-moment basis, create system balance. As we think about the future, that system balance is not completely going to be dispatching generation to meet load, but there's also going to be action on the load side that becomes a resource. So many of the things that Heather mentioned as capabilities of controlling at that level can be aggregated, automated, and become resources to the grid. When we look at the volatility or the aspects of renewable generation that are difficult to manage from the traditional perspective, there's two main sources, and one of them is the renewables that are on the high-voltage grid. Those are the big utility-scale power plants. And where you have a specific resource that's just solar of the solar photovoltaic type, or you have just, say, a wind farm, then those are going to behave as they do when the solar resource is varying throughout the day, when the wind resource is varying throughout the day. But the other source of variability is the point where the distribution system that serves the customers meets the high voltage grid. We call that the transmission distribution interface. And in the California ISO system, there's about 2,500 or 2,800 of those interface points where you leave the high voltage grid, you go down to the distribution system. Traditionally, that's always been passive in one way, and we try to forecast load to manage what it is. But in the future, now, there are more and more devices that are offsetting that load. So solar photovoltaics, rooftop solar, is the predominant form right now. But in the future, that's going to change so that we'll have more controllable resources. Electric vehicles is one good example. So today, large volumes of solar energy being produced in the middle of the day, where does it go? In the future, electric vehicles, greater electrification of transportation, charge it during the day. Workplace charging becomes a way of doing that. New consumer demands like desalination that start coming online to utilize the high volume of energy that's available during the day. And then some ideas that are old, going back to the 80s, like integrating, aggregating air conditioners, aggregating water heaters, aggregating pool pumps, thousands of them through electronic control systems that can simply stagger the time at which these individual devices operate and as a result provide a demand resource that's now dispatchable to manage load at the local end. So one of the concepts that we work on in thinking about managing a grid with more of these variable resources is managing variability close to the source. How can we create incentives so that in an area where you have utility scale solar, can we have a storage facility that's close to that or that's integrated with a wind farm in an area? Can we, at the end use customer level, instead of just putting naked solar PV on your roof, solar plus battery, which as batteries become cheaper, that's going to be part of the business model of companies like SolarCity, so that now less volatility is being put onto the grid and is more managed at the local premises. Microgrids are a really great example of that. So you take something like UC San Diego, where the campus is its own electrical system. It has one point of interconnection with the distribution grid, and it manages all the resources within that local system to maintain as stable an interface with the grid as possible. So technologies are making all of these things possible, from smart buildings to microgrids to that transmission distribution interface where, as Heather mentioned, modernizing the grid, improving the ability of distribution utilities to manage volatility in the local area means that less of it is hitting the high voltage grid. So I guess I'll sort of stop there and see what others want to add.
So this is what's driving the complexity. So the California ISO is responsible for in real-time balancing supply and demand. And when you have the intermittent resources, then you need dispatchable resources, as Lorenzo said, to make sure you have that balance at every moment. And it used to be you had a handful of resources that were large that you could send signals to or would automatically respond in a four-second time frame to keep that supply-demand balance. It's good. What's happening now, though, is we have many, 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 many more resources that can participate in this balancing, and that's what's driving the complexity. But it's also, as Lorenzo said, providing more opportunity to do it more locally. And so what we're looking for in these solutions of batteries and solar or other distributed technologies to be able to react in a distributed way to help manage what's going on the system, whether it's power flow to relieve line loading, because what we worry about at the distribution system is not supply-demand balance. What we're worried about is there enough capacity on that line to carry the power customers need. You don't want to overload it because it gets hot, it burns to the ground. That's not good. We also manage voltage. We got to make sure that our customers' equipment can run appropriately and have the right voltage levels. So that's what we're worried about. And there's equipment out there that manages that based on a set of assumptions that are now outdated. That set of assumptions that power only flows one way doesn't hold true anymore. So I run a group of system planners who think about this and worry about this every day. And so when we put solar out there, there's a large study process that says, okay, if the power is running backwards, will our protection equipment, so these things that make sure it's safe, that when that balloon or that car or that bird or something causes a fault, so lots of current going in, it gets de-energized for safety. And so there's complexity, there's dynamics, but we can solve this technically. We just need to get in front of it.
A couple things to think about as we look to the future. One of the aspects of the Western grid that adds to the difficulty of doing all this is that it's very balkanized. In California, we have five separate balancing authorities. L.A. Department of Water and Power is separate from the Cal ISO grid. Imperial Irrigation District is separated from the Cal ISO grid. They have a point of interconnection, but within those areas, they balance their own stuff. In the West, we have 35 balancing authorities. Okay. In the Midwest, there's one through across 11 states. From a renewable standpoint, broadening the ability to spread the variability over a larger system will make this easier. But there's complexities in governance, complexities in operation, and as we look to have greenhouse gas emission targets met, the power system is going to be the engine that leads towards the achievement of the carbon targets. But for us to decarbonize the power sector, we're going to have to rethink how we do reliability and rethink the role of natural gas. At the moment, natural gas is what we rely on. California, despite all the talk about renewables, we still have 62% natural gas for electricity, and that has increased with the loss of the San Onofre nuclear plant. Okay, and unfortunately, because of a lack of planning and foresight on everybody's part, especially, if I may say, Edison and CAISO, we were unprepared for the loss of San Onofre. And the only thing we knew what to do to keep the lights on was to build a bunch more gas. We weren't yet evolved enough in our thinking, and the PUC remains one of the least evolved in its thinking because it's processes are all siloed in these little individual proceeding, and there's nobody looking at the big picture. When you look at the big picture, as my organization did with a study we did with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, NREL, you can see it at the lowcarbongrid2030.org. When you look at trying to meet a greenhouse gas target, all the pieces have to fit together, and we need to begin to essentially rely on the zero carbon resources to keep the lights on. That means we got to choose them with more than the side salad in mind. We have to think about renewables from the standpoint of what work can they do on the system? How can they contribute to grid reliability? Solar systems today have inverters that suck voltage from the grid. Those inverters need to be replaced and updated and made smart, which available technology can do, so that the solar system can become a partner in making reliability happen. And these are the kind of institutional changes that I think we're in the forefront of trying to make here in California. Hawaii is also integrating a large amount of solar and having some adventures along the way, the Germans also. But these challenges fundamentally are solvable, but they require innovation and creativity that has often been lacking from what has been a fairly staid and traditional system, both with respect to the way it's regulated as well as the way the innovation has come. I think Edison has, because of the San Onofre experience, has forced itself to think about this sooner than most utilities in the country. So even though there's some failures in recent past. I think at the moment there's a lot of innovation going on at the distribution level in the utility and at the ISO. So these are things that are solvable, but they require deep and continued thinking and adjustment based on what we learn from our experience.
Yeah, I want to build on that just a little bit. I think one of the challenges we really have are all of the siloed policies. So there's a RPS target, there's an energy efficiency target, there's a demand response target. All of these are working sometimes at cross purposes. And I think if we could, as a state, focus on what we're trying to do rather than implement so much how, it may allow us to get more innovative and flexible in those solutions. So if we're thinking big, if we're thinking, okay, we need to reduce GHG, and then we take all of these tools we have, demand response, energy efficiency, electric vehicles, energy storage, and put that together as a solution, rather than thou must have 50% renewables, we had an unintended consequence of our renewables. We created a situation where we had to balance it with gas. And so we started those plants more than we ever did. We cycled them more than we ever did. And that has more impact, GHG impact, than we thought it would. And so I just want to think about this more holistically, again, from what are we trying to get? And a little less on all of these individual targets, because they really need to work together.
If I could just add a point here, one of the consequences of the RPS policy was that it was a regulatory requirement on the utility. They had to have X amount of renewables by X date or face penalties. So when you have a mandate like that, there's an emphasis on the part of the regulators, we don't want it to cost too much. We don't want rates to go up. So therefore, what you do when you're under the RPS thinking is you buy the cheapest stuff you can find. The utility is incented to buy the cheapest. The PUC wants the cheapest. But when you look at how that then impacts the system, it's like, oh, I bought the cheapest, but I missed the opportunity, in the specific case of geothermal, to have a 24/7 resource that can provide voltage and inertia and things that a gas or a nuclear plant can provide. But we didn't buy the geothermal because it's too expensive for purposes of meeting the RPS. But if you then take Heather's point of trying to achieve a greenhouse gas target, which will require the same or more amount of renewables, but if you acquire and think in a more integrated fashion, you'll think more about how the pieces fit together, and that from a value proposition standpoint, if a renewable is going to help me avoid incremental gas burn, that's an asset worth counting when we consider what we're willing to pay.
Heather, it's interesting to hear you talk about all the various policies the state have. When you're in this state and you talk to policymakers and who are extremely, many of whom are extremely proud of the greenhouse gas initiatives here, they think the market likes the fact that we have dozens and dozens of different policies that get you to the greenhouse gas reductions, the very ambitious goals that California has. But you're right. Each one is a little cut that is, in its own way, very damaging when you don't consider what it's doing to the whole. So you're right. The bottom line are the RPS standards and goals, and sometimes they get lost.
But, I'd say it doesn't matter as much at lower penetration levels, right. But when you start getting up to above 33%, and then you simultaneously are trying to drive the GHG down, then it really starts to matter how these pieces fit.
But, Lorenzo, you said, and we were talking before about electric cars, and this is going to be a game changer. Oh, boy. And both John and Lorenzo said, but we don't want people in cars. And so in your opening remarks, you said, oh, this isn't a big policy. We can do this. We just need to change behavior and mind. I would suggest to you that changing Americans' behavior and the way we want to go about, don't tell me I can't drive my car, don't tell me I can't crank my air conditioning when it's hot, all the various things, that's a big deal. So I would like each of you, and then we'd really like your questions, to project the grid that you're envisioning, the one that works and that's integrated all the renewables, in terms of, in whatever terms you'd like to cast it, lifestyle, consumers, cost, how we might go about, you know, going to Trader Joe's and getting our stuff, how is that going to look different?
Well, I would start out by saying that consumers are obsolete. Much like dinosaurs. As long as we think of ourselves as consumers, we're doomed. We need to think of ourselves as citizens. And it really comes down to changing our mentality. You know, what John was saying about this pressure to buy the cheapest thing, yeah, that's the way the regulatory system works. Minimize the cost, meet these requirements, et cetera. And the utilities comply with the structure of incentives that they're handed. But we don't include in that calculus what's the cost of not doing something. That never is in there. I was trained as an economist. I got a PhD in economics from UC Davis. And, you know, a common buzzword that economists use to disguise things, I call it an obfuscation, is the word externality. Every time you hear that word, an alarm should go off in your head because there is no such thing. Externality is just the thing that we don't want to talk about. And usually it's a hidden subsidy, or maybe it's not so hidden. Externality is what everybody pays. There are costs of production, costs of consumption that are just not in the calculus of the end-use prices. And so we talk about the market being able to accomplish something. What's the market? There is no such thing. These are all mental constructs. And so it's the mental constructs that are the problem. Let's get rid of the term externalities. Let's get rid of the term consumer. And let's become citizens and think about making changes. What does it take to have resilience in my community, on the street where I live, in the neighborhood where I live, in the city where I live, because resilience is going to depend on being able to sustain a quality of life which requires whole system thinking about municipal services, integrating the electric system into that, and really thinking differently about what we're doing. The thing that about vehicles, electric vehicles, you know, I was at a conference talking about New York trying to increase electric vehicle miles traveled. And I said, well, that's the wrong goal, isn't it? Why do you want to increase vehicle miles traveled? Because we should be thinking about decreasing vehicle miles traveled. If we just swap out an electric vehicle for every gasoline vehicle, we still sit on the freeway for an hour and a half waiting to cross the bridge. Only we're sitting in electric vehicles instead of gasoline vehicles. So it's rethinking maybe the transportation system, but also maybe why are people traveling so many miles? Why are we going so far to go to work? How do we want to rethink work? So, you know, to me, it's not just telling other people that you have to behave differently. It's me deciding that I need to behave differently and actually spreading those ideas in the people who live next door to me and in my neighborhood and at my city council meetings and getting engaged. We need to start ratcheting up the urgency of what's going on because we're all drunk and we're at the edge of the roof.
Well, to be very practical, because we operate the distribution grid every day now, it's evolving every day. Every time we build for our customers, the grid continues to evolve and become smarter. It needs to be. So the future we envision is one where customers get to do what they want and what they've chosen to do. And so we are looking to enable the modern grid as a platform for customers to be able to do what they want to do and not notice, not feel the pain of demand response, not feel that the power's out because there's been a balloon. So we want to build this modern grid that allows customers to do what they want to do. And in order to do this, we need to be very mindful about the pace we build things, what we build, and what makes sense to build. We need to be able to harness what the customers are putting in as part of the grid itself and as that platform, not just we're going to build it all, we're going to own it all. We're not. We are going to provide opportunities for customers to provide grid services, to be part of the grid solution. And so that's what we envision for the future grid.
I think we're going to have to think about I think the concept of citizenship is a really important one that Lorenzo mentioned, and I think we're going to have all the citizens, but also all the technologies, become good citizens of the grid. And you know, there's a mentality when we are relying on the market system and the incentives and capital impulse to just get more of what I'm selling, whether it's rooftop solar or wind or natural gas. And what we have to start thinking about is what's the purpose we're serving, and how do we take the attributes that the grid needs, which are both at the distribution level and at the transmission level, and be sure that it works together. I think one of the bridges between these systems is large-scale storage. The Department of Water Resources, but one of the things that's embedded in what Heather just said is that the idea that the bundled customers or the utilities are going to be the platform by which all of this infrastructure gets purchased and paid for, it has to come to grips with the fact that the utilities are seeing competition for their load from different other providers, whether it's community choice aggregators or rooftop solar or other distributed forms. So thinking about how we're going to finance the infrastructure that we need, and we can't do it all with simply rooftop solar or the distributed. We're going to need bulk transmission and bulk resources to run the entire grid. And large-scale storage, particularly the existing dams that the Department of Water Resources has and that the utilities have, need to be organized in such a fashion that they can be a base of support and flexibility. And it may be we need to think about a new institutional form to manage these dams, as well as to maybe build some new large-scale storage, whether it's compressed air or thermal storage. There's a lot of storage technologies in addition to batteries. But the value that those resources can provide, the displacement of natural gas that they can provide, has to be, those costs have to be recovered in association with the benefits that they're producing. And this is going to be an area where we need some creativity and maybe to try some new things, like having a large-scale storage operator that would work with the CalISO and the utilities to minimize the gas burn. Because if we're going to get to the 2030 target, we're going to have to greatly reduce the amount of gas that we're burning, and that means other resources have to be deployed to do that same work. And that's the mentality that we're going to have to get to, instead of simply saying, I want to sell more and more on the side of the system and assume that the system is going to balance itself, because increasingly all of us have to take responsibility for meeting these challenges. The good news is making a more resilient, low-carbon grid is going to be good for the economy, and it's going to, in the end, lower costs. And that is the reason to do it, in addition to achieving the goals and the policies that have been aggregated all together, but which I think we need a planning function for this infrastructure that is more integrated and more holistic than anything that we're currently doing.
Okay, we're a room full of journalists, so let's ask questions. Wonderful. I think the best way to handle it, since we don't have those ridiculous ushers with the things, we'll be able to hear you, but please say your name and your affiliation, and then I'll probably have to repeat the question for the recording, but go right ahead. Just stand up, somebody. There you go.
Hi, thank you for the discussion today. My name is Aaron. I'm a freelancer based out of Albany, New York at the moment. I had a question, I guess, based on cost, and it's really cool. So one of the things, I'm actually working part-time with an ESCO. They're complaining sort of a little bit. I asked about, basically they're saying, at least this is the case in New York State, that the price of solar and wind, for instance, as low as it's going to get for now, and it's still higher than non-renewables, in part because the cost of fracked gas at the moment is really low and it's undercutting everything. So I guess my question is basically, what are some ways to to lower the price of renewable energy at the moment, or some strategies.
Who wants to take on the idea that renewables competing against carbon fuels price? One of you two.
I think renewables do better against natural gas than nuclear, for one thing. Secondly, I think it partly gets to figuring out the value proposition, because I think this is where I think you have to move renewables into the mainstream and use them to run the grid. And that means in coordination with the existing resources as well. But I think for the moment, the existing subsidies, the production tax credit for wind and the investment tax credit for solar, offset the current advantage that natural gas has. But if you put any kind of carbon price and combine it with any reasonable forecast of what the future price of gas is going to be, this is not going to continue forever. And I think for the moment, a combination of policies to overcome the embedded subsidies in a fossil system is what we're going to have to improvise. But in the meantime, I think we need to visualize how the system can be run with the low carbon resources and how we can work across regional grants. You know, in the Northeast, we've got the Quebec Hydro up there that could be a very nice complement to the things that are going on. So I think this is something where we have to – each region will have a different set of attributes and a different set of resources, and the key is how to get them coordinated.
Okay. I'll follow up with that real quick. I mean, so do you think it's more – what is it more likely that those policy solutions will come around, I guess, at the regional or per state level or federal level?
I think the Clean Power Plan, which obligates the states, can be implemented at a regional level.
Mm-hmm. I would add to that the recognition that small-scale distributed resources can take advantage of multiple value streams that they haven't done so much up to now, that devices located behind the meter, and Rocky Mountain Institute did one on storage that essentially laid all this out very nicely, that said if you locate storage devices behind the customer meter, they can take advantage of a revenue stream from the customer by helping to offset bills, especially where there's demand charges like commercial and industrial customers. They can provide services to the distribution system and actually get paid for those services, perhaps offsetting an infrastructure investment. And they can be aggregated and participate in the wholesale market and earn a revenue stream that way. So that's part of the way that these things can actually earn revenues that help to make them more financially viable.
How about in the back? You're already standing. The question is the idea that you would separate large users of a grid and create microgrids, and the second is fear of repeating Enron, whoever.
Well, I would certainly say that something called caliphobia exists throughout the Western region as a result of that little mishap that Enron was involved in back in the year 2000. Not well understood, unfortunately, but you know, when John was talking earlier about taking advantage of the broader Western region and forming fewer balancing authority areas than we have today to be able to optimize the use of flexible resources, to be able to take better advantage of time of day differences, different time zones of when you're getting solar energy, different weather patterns that exist in different parts, and then being able to share those resources. Certainly the shadow of Enron makes it difficult for parties to get beyond wanting to control their own little local systems and be part of that larger system. In terms of the question of customer categories separating out. I guess I don't think of it that way. I think there will be the growth of local systems, but they will take advantage usually of either electrical configurations or of some natural common interest that they have. For example, a university campus or a major medical center or an industrial park. You might have industrial commercial customers in an electrically contiguous area that wants to create a microgrid for greater resilience. I think it'll be more of a bottom-up phenomenon, as we're seeing in New York after it responded to Hurricane Sandy, and resilience became a central word in all of the policy discussions there. We will see essentially opportunistic development of these kinds of self-contained systems that can island when there's a major disruption to the grid. But it's not necessarily categorized by the customer type.
Yeah, I would just say two things. First of all, there is a lot of innovation coming from the commercial industrial customers that want to get completely off of fossil fuels as part of their corporate branding. So the Apple campus down in Santa Clara County is an example of that. We've also got examples where customers like Facebook and others that have large data centers are wanting to do their own renewable deals to buy projects. So I think I agree with Lorenzo that there's going to be an innovation that comes from the bottom up. I also think we need to pay particular attention to bringing the benefits of the low-carbon future to low-income communities and disadvantaged communities. And I think this is where combinations of targeted energy efficiency. We've got a program down in the Coachella Valley where there is a company has put together a package where instead of having to do an energy audit, you just basically try to install attic insulation in all the homes that don't have it. Just, you know, 2 hours, $2,000, 20% reduction. Okay, we should be doing that in Central Valley, then giving them a Nest thermostat so they can do demand response and maybe do community solar instead of trying to put it on everybody's rooftop, create a community center where we'll have, you can charge your phones, you can spend some back into the grid, but we need to be sure these benefits are spread throughout the system. We have a terrific amount of inequality and poverty in California, and these things should be part of our thinking when we're deploying these resources. And that's why I do think thinking about communities and what they can do with either community solar or microgrids, along with how to make the whole system be able to talk to itself and take advantage of the technologies that are currently under development.
Let me add one footnote to John's point. The case of San Antonio, Texas, I think is very interesting. There are municipal utility there, and they wanted solar to penetrate to all income levels in the community. And what they decided to do was the local municipal utility would buy the solar panels, put them on the sunniest roofs irrespective of income level, and then pay rent about 2 to 3 cents a kilowatt hour to have the solar panel on your roof, and those solar panels then become a resource for the utility to provide all the customers in its territory. So it's getting beyond this notion of, oh, I want solar on my roof and its size just to meet my needs, to recognizing that sunny roofs are a community resource. Let's utilize them and not create incentives for somebody with a shady roof to cut down their trees so that they can have solar power.
John Addison, Meeting of the Minds. I think some specifics might help us all. I'm very interested in aggregators, and maybe we could start specifically post Aliso Canyon. I think there have been some really innovative awards for intelligent storage, including thermal. Could you kind of walk us through how there's going to be a reduction of future use and the implementation of some of these?
The question is about aggregation.
The procurement of energy storage for Aliso Canyon was amazing. We are implementing a large amount of energy storage in a very short amount of time. These projects will be online before the end of the year. And they're large installations. Yeah, the end of this year. I shouldn't have said end of a year, because who knows when that'll be, is very exciting. I was talking with one of the developers about their particular installation, and they are implementing a 80 megawatt hour facility out in Pomona to help with this. So this energy storage is being installed in different places around the system. And how it will help reduce the peaking plants that come on is that energy storage will be centrally dispatched by the ISO that has a big picture of all these resources, and they will use that energy storage when needed to absorb any excess solar at the time. Yes. But then also to discharge when we're at peak versus turning on a peaker plant. So we at Edison make sure that those resources can connect to the system, and when they're centrally dispatched from the ISO, they can respond to that, and then our system will be able to carry that power on our wires. And so it's a very exciting implementation. We've implemented other kinds of energy storage through our other procurement efforts as well, our LCR procurement, local capacity resource procurement, as well as our preferred resources pilot. So in those, there have been thermal energy storage awards where there's, you know, things like the Ice Bear that, you know, uses ice and you don't have to turn on the compressors that cost a lot more energy at peak. So there's a lot of advancements in energy storage that are really going to help reduce the number of times you need to turn on a peaker.
And I would emphasize that the role of aggregation will continue to become more and more important and more valuable, because if you just look at an individual customer premises installing specific devices or generating or battery resources, if only the customer gets the value of that, there's a lost revenue stream, there's a lost value opportunity that an aggregator can capture by looking over a large number of those customers, aggregating those devices, putting in control systems and technologies that enable them to dispatch, and then offering them into the ISO to provide imbalance energy for 5-minute dispatch, to provide what we call regulation service, which is to be on a 4-second signal to balance frequency on the grid. All of those revenue streams become additional sources of value that help balance the grid and displace the need to run fossil plants.
The other thing I would just say is that Aliso Canyon, it was a huge wake-up call and almost like a black swan event, because everybody assumed that reliability is provided by natural gas peakers and related infrastructure. But when there's doubt about the safety and feasibility of sustaining the supply of that gas, as there now is, suddenly you look at your options, much differently. And I think I give Edison a terrific amount of credit for it. You know, we talk about mandates. You know, California adopted a 1,300 megawatt distributed storage mandate. Edison's share of that mandate was a couple hundred megawatts or maybe a little more, but they almost tripled, I think, what they bought, not based on the mandate, but on the fact that the system needed it, and they looked at their options and say, do we want to see how this Aliso Canyon thing turns out? We want to bet the future reliability of the system on that facility getting back in service, even though there's a lot of concerns about the reliability of it. So that was a moment when I think our planning got a jolt. And instead of thinking that it's always going to be gas that we use to balance the system, we're finding that we can deploy these advanced low-carbon technologies together to meet the attributes that are needed. One of the things about reliability that Lorenzo just touched on is that there's different things that the system needs at different times. And those attributes can be provided in different ways. If we can, in fact, find a way to get the revenue stream balanced to the value and the service that can be provided through both the distributed as well as the zero carbon resources.
I would just add one footnote to John's point about the wake-up call. I think Aliso Canyon was a wake-up call in another important way, which is this belief that gas is somehow clean. When you count all the methane that was spewed out of Aliso Canyon and the environmental damage of that, then if you look at the whole life cycle of natural gas and all the leakages along the way, it's not so clean anymore. It's only clean because of what these things I mentioned earlier, externalities, that never figure into the price. You know, so it looks artificially low cost, artificially cleaner than others. But that fallacy, I think, has been burst.
If you're Googling Aliso Canyon, don't live in California, it's a natural gas storage field operated by Edison that...
Southern California Gas.
Excuse me. Whoa. Exactly right. Southern California Gas. Pardon me. You don't have gas. I know that. There was a leak. It was near a lot of homes. In the back.
I'm Amy Martin. I'm a freelance radio reporter, and I started a new podcast about environmental issues. And this is like kind of the 30,000 or more foot level, but I just kind of want to throw out a way of framing what's going on and have you tell me what's wrong or right about it. It seems like we're trending towards enhanced, increased distributed generation, so more and more people making their own energy, and that's probably going to keep growing in the future. But that what the grid needs in order to be stable is for large numbers of power generators to be working together in some ways. And that seems like there's an inherent tension there, like we need this giant system that kind of balances all this variability, while at the same time more and more people are wanting to, and the technology is growing, that we can generate our own energy, which kind of also helps limit the bad side of having these giant centralized power generation stations. Is it true that those two things are happening, and is it true that they're in tension, or can we have a big grid with a whole bunch of little distributors in it that is stable?
The question is about the tension between bulk distribution and DG.
Yeah, I think we can absolutely have that future grid where all of these things work together. And in fact, that's really, you know, what our vision is in this paper that Edison published last week. And we're doing it in a lot of different ways. One of the ways we're doing it is in technology. So John mentioned previously about smart inverters. So inverters attached to energy storage, wind, and solar, and can be made to be helpful to the grid as well. And so the PUC, our PUC, went about a requirement to have smart inverters installed in all new installations. We have since gotten the UL, and so all new installations will start having these smart inverters, which is one step in having these resources be good citizens of the grid. And so I don't see this in competition necessarily. You know, this is an all-of-the-above solution. We need to change how we operate. We need to evolve differently. We are getting an understanding of how these things work. We are piloting these things to make sure that we understand how they can work so that the grid can be this platform for this new generation.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I think there is a really clear complementarity between the large high-voltage grid and the movement towards decentralization that we're seeing. The idea that we were talking about a few moments ago of consolidating balancing authorities and getting the efficiencies of geographic diversity and load diversity and so on, that's very real. And so we want to keep the grid around, but at the same time, we expect that the volume of energy that flows over that grid is going to be gradually decreasing as we have more resilient local systems being developed. So you'll have this complementarity of a large-scale system that's designed for a future world where there's a whole lot of variability or variation in models and systems at the local level, and the grid accommodates those through ideas like local resources managing variability locally, through smart inverters and batteries balancing solar resources. So the future that we end up going towards is is a grid that still exists with the infrastructure we have today, but we use it a lot more efficiently. The overall volume of energy flowing over it is less. We're able to reach remote areas like Wyoming or northern New Mexico where there's good wind or solar resources and share that energy across the system. But at the same time, we do it efficiently because now a lot more of the load is being served locally, and those local systems are able to be resilient, are able to function as islands in areas where, or in instances where, there's a disruption to the large grid service. And also they're able to be customized at the local level to integrate the essential municipal services that are part of maintaining local resilience.
The question is, what's the role of baseload power?
Do you want to start or do you want me to?
Well, he wanted to hear from Heather, so go ahead. But, and I'll follow, or John can follow.
Okay. So baseload power helps when you have, obviously, a very stable amount of electric use, right? In California, because of our weather pattern and just because of how things are, we have a very variable load shape. So we go from, 50,000 megawatt peak?
It's not quite, but getting there, yeah.
And then a low would be about?
20,000.
Mm. So you've got, 30,000 megawatts of capacity that fills in those gaps. And so as, that we get to that base load need and serving that base load, yes, we want to serve it. We want to serve it cleanly. However, because of the variable uses our customers have, we need to be able to have flexibility to provide them power when they need it from where they need it. And then energy storage is going to be a big game changer in this, because if you can move around, when you have high renewable or sufficient renewable on the system and store that and then use it at the peak, it's going to change how we serve that power.
Yeah, I would add a little bit to that from ISO perspective. The concept of baseload power is very much a central station paradigm concept. And so the idea is, here's the load out there, and it's all just doing something, and we have to be able to balance our system to serve that load. So we have the stuff, the 20,000 that we mentioned, that's running all the time, and you never have to dispatch it because it's always going to be load to use that up. Then you have intermediate plants that fill these sort of the daily load cycle. And then you have these peakers that come on for a relatively small number of hours of the year when you're hitting your peak demand. So that's the traditional paradigm. But it's based on the assumption that we've got to meet it all through central supply, and out there the customers, the consumers, the end users are going to be just using power, and we have no control over them. So as we shift towards more production at the local side, and as batteries become cheaper and at individual premises, you can now have a relatively stable supply of energy to meet your demand through the combination of storage, electronic control systems, vehicle charging, solar panels on the roof, thermal storage. All of those things start to create that baseload energy in a decentralized manner.
I would also say that it depends on what kind of baseload you're talking about. In the case of Diablo Canyon's nuclear facility, it's 2,000 megawatts of baseload in a place that is not exactly making use of it, so most of it's got to come out of there. You've also got to have a large dam to back it up because of the basically, it needs to have spinning reserve behind it in case something happens. I think there are other kinds of baseload plants. Coal plants would be in the same category. One of the reasons coal is having a hard time being competitive is because They're not cheaper anymore than the gas that's available, and the gas is more flexible. I think a couple exceptions that I would make, first of all, I'd say that the key is to have a balanced portfolio. One of the things California tends to do is fall in love with one particular thing at a time and buy only that. So we fell in love with combined cycle natural gas in the 90s and the aughts, and that's all we bought. Then we fell in love with wind because it was the cheapest way to meet the RPS. Now we're in love with solar and batteries, okay? And that's what everybody's talking about, and that's where the money's going and so forth. And there's terrific innovation going on, as Heather said, on the storage side. I think there's still a role for some traditional baseload renewables like geothermal and biomass that have the ability to provide substantial amount of that 20,000 megawatts that we know we're going to need regardless with a very modest environmental footprint. Or in the case of bioenergy, where you're meeting other social objectives like reduction of methane or the disposal of some of the dead trees that we have. That's the other thing. This is not a panel about water or dead trees, but those water and forestry are going to impact the power sector system at some point. I think the Salton Sea and the intersection between desalination, minerals extraction, restoration of the Salton Sea is going to be a place where there's going to be different value created. And if you think about it only from the electricity standpoint and thinking, well, I don't really want that because A, it's more expensive, and B, because it's not flexible, you have to think of what other attributes these resources bring. So I think in general we're moving away, as Lorenzo said, from the baseload central station paradigm, but there is still value for some of these resources even if they basically run all the time. In the case of geothermal, you can do some day-ahead flexibility by changing when the power is delivered, and the key for all the resources is to provide value to the system when the system needs it. And if you're not able to think that way, if you simply want to be bought because you're cool or you're green, that paradigm is also, we're moving away from that because it's not enough to simply be renewable. It's also important that you add value to the work that the grid is having to do.
Anybody? We have time for more questions. Sammy. The question is about geothermal and pumped hydro.
I don't know what I'd add. Pumped hydro certainly is a very flexible type of resource and has great value in that. And John was talking earlier about the possibilities through the Department of Water Resources to enhance the effectiveness of facilities that already exist. It's very hard to create new pumped hydro because ultimately it takes up a significant footprint. But certainly in terms of the quality of the resource, and similarly geothermal in terms of the quality of the resource, I think they're very good types of resources that provide what the grid needs.
Yeah, for us, as John mentioned earlier, we procure the needed power regardless of the resource. So we go through proceedings at the PUC that talk about the needs of the grid. And so then we would go and procure that power, you know, based on an RFP so that any resource can provide that. Right now, we don't have a need to procure power. We are procuring power to meet our RPS targets, as well as to provide the needed flexibility that the ISO would require in these. But right now, there's a surplus of energy because of the RPS goals. And so, we are, again, trying to get what's needed at the lowest cost that we can get it and the best resource we can get it from.
Resilience and
The question is about the cost of this new grid.
So, well, the cheapest thing would be to do nothing. So, and that would be really cheap. So that should make everybody happy. I guess the problem that I always have with these economic cost discussions is, what's the cost of not doing something? And that never figures in there. What's the cost of continuing to have an Aliso Canyon and rely on gas? Let's not swap out the resources, but if you look at the whole life cycle of gas, it's not clean. What's the cost of continuing to operate in business as usual? That doesn't get in there. What are people willing to pay for? What I find really ironic and disturbing about the way we talk about the cost question is that we view money as real and ecosystem constraints as negotiable. To me, that is pretty upside down. That air and water and food and the basic things that we require to sustain life are facts of the environment that are not negotiable. They're demonstrating more and more that they're not. And money is a human creation. It's a total fiction. So which one is real?
I don't want to rain on Lorenzo's quite exquisite disquisition on the value proposition for humanity, but I will say, because that's normally my line as an environmentalist. But
sorry.
So I want to say is that I'm going to take the economic question for the moment. When we looked at how to get to a low carbon grid target in 2030 versus not. What we discovered is that without heroic assumptions about cost or economics or the price of gas or the price of carbon, in the end, it was either break even or a little bit cheaper, depending on the assumptions, to achieve these goals of reduction, because when you use renewables, you're not burning and paying for fuel. The capital cost. The key variable for the economics of gas is the cost of the gas. The key variable for the cost of renewables is the cost of money. And one of the things that's important about a plan that is backed up by policy is that it can reduce the risk and reduce the cost that it takes to build these resources. So I think the cost numbers are surprisingly good, at least out here, and I can't speak to other parts of the country, but I think if you look at the grid holistically and think about a planning for the future that includes low cost, reliability, and low carbon, the cost is not the reason not to do it. It may be that we can't organize ourselves successfully to execute, but I don't think it's the cost that is the principal barrier.
We don't plan the grid for resiliency right now. We plan it for reliability. They're different. So reliability is to make sure that the lights stay on and we plan for contingencies. So if we lose a transmission line or we lose a generator, we can keep the power flowing. So we plan for reliability. Resiliency is really about how quick can you come back. And we don't invest that directly right now in the grid. It isn't a planning criteria. So it's one of these things about, are we willing to pay for it? You know, we are very careful about balancing the upgrades and the evolution we put in the grid to keep it affordable, to keep costs down. So we don't directly plan for a resiliency metric, but what we do look at is, especially as we get these local generation resources, we now see where power can flow and continue to supply that local load. And in doing that, we need to build in more operational flexibility in our distribution system through things like more ties between circuits. So the distribution system's radial. So you come from the transmission system, which it all flows all together in a network. And then when it gets to distribution, it hits an end, and there's like one wire going to, you know, this, you know, in customer neighborhood. So it's radial. You don't have power coming from everywhere. What we do, though, is there's a radial over here going to this neighborhood, one over here going to this neighborhood. We put in a tie line between those and a switch that's open so that when something happens over here, you can close that and keep the power flowing. We need more of those. We need more of these technologies that enable us to have this operational flexibility so we can continue to use the power that customers are putting at their own locations, as well as make sure that we can can recover when a balloon, a tree, a squirrel, you know, happens to the wires when, you know, that stuff's just going to continue to happen.
Thank you, everyone, for your attention to our dense topic, and I'm sure we all thank our panelists. Thank you so much.
You guys are awesome. Thank you.